This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Brian Coryat is here. He is, amongst other things, the founder and CEO of Local Market Launch, which is a local company here in town who is hiring, aggressively hiring. They've already hired several folks from UCSB. And I think it's a company that has a great future in front of it. What they do is they help small businesses obtain search visibility. So it's, you know, if you're a big company with a sophisticated marketing team, it's, you know, you can do it on your own. But if you run a dry cleaner, you run a pizza place, you run a barber shop, you're not an internet person, you don't have the background or the time or the inclination to figure it out. How do you get online? How does somebody find your business? And that's what Brian's company is solving. Brian also founded ValueClick, where he was the CEO and director of sales at the company's inception. So success has many fathers, failure is an orphan. Many people would like to say they were part of the beginning of ValueClick. Brian founded ValueClick from day one. He was the guy. It's just kind of funny because I'll be around town and people will be like, yeah, I was there at the beginning. Well, this guy was really there. He was the beginning. He served as the company's president from its inception all the way through February of 2000, and then he was a director thereafter. He was also their chief operating officer and their vice chairman and as the company got larger. ValueClick's current valuation as of today is $1.55 billion. It is a multi-billion dollar corporation that's publicly traded. It started on State Street. Dreams do come true. Brian made that happen. Brian and his team. But again, without Brian kind of kicking the ball off, it wouldn't have happened. They've purchased a number of notable companies themselves. So they purchased Commission Junction. They purchased Atomi most recently. And they also purchased Santa Barbara success story called FastClick. So Brian's experience before he founded ValueClick, he also founded WebIgnite, which was an internet promotions company, and he ran that from 96 to 98. It was a precursor of ValueClick. And his very first internet startup, which he'll tell us about, he started in September of 1994. You're looking at an internet pioneer up here. Brian was here at the beginning, and he's got some great stories about what life was like on the internet in 1994. Let's welcome Brian to our class.
Forget about all that stuff till I hear it again. Sounds pretty good on paper. Thanks, guys. My wife and I were talking a couple of weeks ago, and I mentioned that I'm going to be doing a guest lecture over at UCSB. And she and the other people say, oh, what are you going to talk about? And I said, well, I don't know. John and I talked about doing an interview thing, and I'm not really sure. I think I'll just wing it. And, of course, the butterflies went through my stomach, and they all looked at me horrified. But the more I started to think about it, I said, well, why the hell not? Why not just wing it? I mean, that's what entrepreneurs do every day. We get up in the morning, and especially in a startup environment, an environment of extreme uncertainty, and we wing it. When I got up Monday, I had no idea what I was going to walk into, which was pretty much kind of a storm going between two of our employees that needed some rectifying and some talking and this whole thing. And I had no idea that I was walking into that, and I just showed up, and there it was in front of me, and I dealt with it, and I just winged it, and it all turned out fine. Everybody's still there, and everybody's happy. When I went into work today, I didn't realize that Monday morning we're going to be pitching UPS on a big contract on a product that, guess what, it doesn't even exist, and I'm going to wing it. But that's what entrepreneurs do every day. We get up in the morning and we wing it. And my life has been kind of winging it from day one. So today I'm going to wing it. I kind of want that to be a theme because that, to me, is part of what entrepreneurship is. So here you have it, unedited, unrehearsed, and uncut. So maybe it won't stay uncut. We'll see what happens. So I guess I'll start with the story of Brian Coryat, because it makes it really easy to wing it, because that's my story. And I was thinking about it, and I literally did not think about it until the drive over here. But I remembered that I'm 51 years old, so about probably 35, 37 years ago, I saw the schedule, the catalog for UCSB. And I grew up in a small town called Long Beach, New York, which is a little barrier town off Long Island. and I surfed, and that was one of the most important things to me. And I looked at the cover of UCSB, and here was this perfect right point coming around, and they must have taken it on the biggest day of the year, and there were these perfect waves, and there were like five guys in the water. I said, oh my God, that's where I want to go to school. And then I started to read articles about it. When I came across and found out it was the biggest party in school in the country, I said, that's my place. But as it turns out, I didn't get to go to UCSB. I didn't get to go to college at all. What I didn't realize is how difficult school was going to become for me, because when I started to learn math, when I started to learn reading and writing, it was all very difficult for me. Turns out that I found out not until 7 or 8 years ago, really, that I'm dyslexic. But back then, when I was, you know, 13, 14, 12, you weren't dyslexic. You were dumb, or maybe you were lazy, or maybe you just didn't care. So when you're given the choice between dumb and lazy, well, I picked lazy. So I would just hang out with the lazy kids and screw off and cut school and not go to class and sleep at my desk. So my school career didn't really go as planned. And the ability to memorize the times table just wouldn't stay with me. It won't stay with me to this day. I cannot memorize the multiplication tables. Well, back before calculators, believe it or not, or they actually had them, but they were about this big and they didn't let you use them because it was cheating. You could not advance in mathematics because they start to teach you basic algebra, you're lost. You can't get by the calculations. They start to teach you trigonometry, forget it, you're just done. If you can't write, they didn't have word processors, they didn't have computers, they didn't have spell checkers. I can't spell, my writing is atrocious, my sentence structure is terrible. If I don't have a computer to fix that up and put it all together, which I can do now, well, then I can never get to tell the story because I'm all hung up on the writing, the reading, and the sentence structure. So my career through high school was pretty much a disaster, and I pretty much barely, they kicked me out of it. I made it, I got a diploma, but they basically gave it to me. They handed it to me, get the hell out of here, and we don't want to see you again, and good luck on your endeavors. So what happened was I went to a technical school. I went to a technical school for electronics, and a funny thing happened. I went into this class, and I started to study electronics, and the first thing the teacher did was he taught the students to use a slide rule, which is a caveman version of a calculator. And a slide rule was great for me because all of a sudden, not only could I visualize these numbers and visualize mathematics, I was able to actually have something to remember my times table. So next thing you know, I'm doing algebra, I'm doing trigonometry, and within a couple of months, it became very apparent I was like the smartest guy in the whole school. And they couldn't believe this genius. Where did this guy come from? How did he even end up in technical school? This guy is running circles around the entire school. He's passing all the tests. He's advancing. And another thing happened was I was able to actually visualize circuitry. I could open up in a schematic and look at circuitry, and I would literally in my mind visualize circuitry. So to me, that's my dyslexia. That's my visual thinking. Dyslexic people, I learned later on in life, are just highly, highly visual thinkers. So I did not get to go to college. So I went into a career in electronics, and it was a great career, and I was very good at it. I could pretty much fix anything. It took me overseas. I lived in Spain for 5 years, met my wife there, and later on came back to California and ended up by happenstance here in Santa Barbara, California, to work for Raytheon at Goleta. Well, of course, like all of you guys, or most of you guys, what happened there was we fell in love with Santa Barbara. And my wife being from Spain and Santa Barbara having the fiesta, my wife dances flamenco. They have the, you know, it's like New Spain. And she loved it. She absolutely adored it. And she says, Brian, she says, I want to live here for the rest of my life. I said, well, I said, honey, I got bad news for you. A house here is like nearly $300,000. There's no way in hell we can ever pay for a house here. There's no way. I only make 20 bucks an hour, and, you know, top end is 30 bucks an hour. She said, well, figure something out. We got to stay here, whatever we do. So, okay, so being a good husband, I went diligently to work. And I'd always thought about being an entrepreneur. I always had it in my heart. I was a terrible employee. I wanted to get up and do things that I want to do every day and the way I want to do it. And so I always was attracted to entrepreneurship. So I started to read books about entrepreneurship. So I started to listen to books. So I was working at Raytheon. I'd be doing my electronics and fixing things. I'd started to listen to all these business books. And I listened to a business book that talked about, you know, how to make money with these tiny classified ads in the back of the magazine. So these tiny classified ads, you run a little tiny classified ad, say, you know, get the brochure to learn more about how to start a business at home. And you send in a stamped, self-addressed stamped envelope. It seems like a million years now. It seems like, why would anybody go through all this trouble? But this is the way it was back then. So I read this book and explained this process of running little classified ads, getting a self-addressed stamped envelope, sending them a brochure. They send that back with a check. You send them a book. And so I started to do that because it made sense to me. And my wife and I started this little business called Home Business Solutions. And we started to sell these books dedicated to running home businesses. And we worked and we worked and we worked and we stuffed envelopes and we ran these little classified ads. We got all these envelopes in and we would stuff the envelopes with the brochures. And we started to grow this company in our one-bedroom apartment. We were kitty corner to City College over on Loma Alta. I don't know if you know that neighborhood. So my wife was taking ESL classes because she didn't speak any English. I was taking a couple of business classes, and we started to grow this company. And every day there would be more boxes, and every day there'd be more envelopes. And we would sit there like oopaloopas, you know, and just oopaloopa, and the stamping, and the licking, and the sealing, and more envelopes. And then we got to a point where I would fill mailboxes with all these envelopes going out. And I had to actually, you know, drive around. Okay, I'll hit this mailbox. Okay, it's full. And I'll hit the other mailbox. It's full. And so we ended up with all these envelopes and this one-bedroom apartment had boxes stacked all over the place, and people thought we were nuts, you know, and I guess we were. But we started to build something. And then I developed a 32-page catalog of all these business books, and I went out and I started to buy the rights from people who have written these books, because back then you couldn't just publish on Kindle. You couldn't snap your finger and have something published and hope somebody buys it. You had to actually find a publisher, print thousands or tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of books, and somehow have people publicize them for you. So there were lots of these authors that wrote great books, and they couldn't sell them. So I went to these authors, and I'd offer them, you know, $500 for reprint rights, you know, just, you know, non-exclusive reprint rights. And they'd be like, shit, you know, $500, I'll take $500, here you go. And I would reprint their books. So I developed that into a business, and that was my first business called Home Business Solutions, or Enterprising Solutions was the company. And we ended up growing that company. We moved up to a two-bedroom apartment with a garage, and then I volunteered for the layoff at Raytheon when they were going through the layoffs, I guess in about 91, and we were able to take that business totally, you know, and just run it out of the garage. We had one employee, and we started to become entrepreneurs. And every day we would get up, and we'd mail out these catalogs, and we'd have them shipped by companies, and we were printing them by the tens of thousands, and we started to develop it. And it was my first taste of entrepreneurship. It was a hell of a lot of work for just a few hundred bucks a week, but we were on our own, we were doing it, and it was growing. We had a couple of employees. And that's when the internet came around. And I get a phone call one day, and a guy says to me, he says, hey, you know, yeah, are you Brian Corriott? Yeah, I said, yeah, I'm Brian Corriott. He says, I'm looking at your catalog right now. And it was a 32-page catalog at the time. He says, this is very interesting, very interesting. I like this. I said, great. Would you like to place an order? He says, well, no, I want to put your catalog on the internet. I said, well, what's the internet? And he says, oh, the internet is the next big thing. There are 40 million people already on the internet. And he started to explain to me the whole concept of this internet. And this is, again, 1994. And I'm thinking, wow, really? Okay. It sounds good. It sounds like this could work. And my two biggest expenses were printing and postage. And I said, wow, if I didn't have to send out and stuff all those stupid envelopes and send them out and mail out all these catalogs, people could look at them online. And then I wouldn't even have to print the books. People could download them. I said, wow, you know, I could turn this business into a gold mine. So I said, well, what does it take? He said, well, $200 setup, and we'll give you your own web page in this Tar Heel Mall, it was called. All right? It was going to be the next Amazon, or the original Amazon, I guess it would be, because it was way before Amazon. And people will start coming to you, and they'll start ordering your products. And we'll give it to you free for a year, and then after that, you have to pay $50 a month at 5% of sales. I said, okay, that sounds reasonable. Let's do that. So he puts it up on the internet, and I literally had to go out and get a computer and get a dial-up account and figure out how to get on the internet to look at this webpage. And I looked at it, I was like, wow, this is great. And back then it was pretty much, it was black and white. The monitor was black and white. Okay, and the catalog was black and white, but there it was, and it was kind of like a scanned photo of the catalog. But hey, what, you know, if people can order my books, I'm happy. So I went about my business and didn't get any orders from the internet, but I started to get acclimated with the internet, started to use some email, and before you know it, we grew the business a little bit, and maybe we're, you know, making $1,000 a week. And I get a call from the guy again. And he says, hey, yeah, how's it going? I said, great, how are you doing? He says, well, it's been a year and you need to start paying a percentage of $50 a month. I say, well, I haven't got any orders. Has it been a year, really? He's like, yeah, it's been a year. I said, well, I haven't got any orders on the internet. He says, well, who's been to your webpage? I said, well, I don't know. Can you look at that? And he said, oh, yeah, we have logs. We can see everything. And so he says, hold on a minute. He types into his computer, and I hear him typing, and he says, well, one person was there yesterday and two people there on Sunday, and then there was a visit on Friday. I said, well, that was me. I was looking to make sure the thing was still alive, you know. So he says, I said, but nobody's going there but me? And he says, well, what are you doing to promote it? And I said, well, what do you mean promote it? You didn't tell me I had to promote it. You told me 40 million people were going to be at my webpage. He says, well, you need to promote it. I said, okay, and how do you do that? He said, well, you have to print door flyers and hang them on doorknobs and put it in those tiny classified ads in back of magazines and put it on your letterhead and put it everywhere and distribute it and run an advertisement in the newspaper. And I thought, man, this guy's full of crap. You know, that's not the way I find things on the internet. And I started to think about it. I said, well, how do I find things on the internet? And I said, well, and back then it was really hard because the internet didn't make any sense. It was just this thing, and you couldn't find anything. But there was this one site that somebody told me about, or maybe I read about it. It was called Yahoo. And it was run by some college students up north here in Stanford. And I went to Yahoo, and Yahoo was very small, very rudimentary back then. It was smaller than anything you can even find on the internet right now. And I looked at it, but that's what I used because it had the cool sites. It was kind of more like a cool site of the day type of website. And so I said, well, how do I get added? You know, and there's no business category. And how do I put my business on here? And I couldn't figure it out. So I sent an email to webmaster@yahoo.com. And I got an email back, and it says, oh, well, yeah, we can put it on. But, you know, so you wanted to talk to me. So I ended up calling the dorm, and he called me back, and we traded phone calls. Finally, I get a hold of him, and he was a nobody, I was a nobody, but this was Jerry Yang, the founder of ValueClick. I don't know if you heard of him, but he got him on the phone. He says, oh, yeah, I like that catalog. Yeah, oh, yeah, I like that webpage. Yeah, we'll put that on Yahoo. I said, oh, great, thanks a lot. And next day, I get two orders. I said, wow, two orders. I got two orders. There are people, and I still didn't know how many people were coming to the website or anything. The next day, I got three orders. I said, wow, this is great. So I started to understand how this internet thing was evolving. And I said, well, I'm going to make it my life's mission. Every morning I'm going to spend the first hours of my day. I'm going to get up and crawl the internet. I'm going to find places to get my website linked up. And that's what I did, 3, 4 hours, 5 hours every day. And I'd find a link here, link there, link somewhere else. And I was able to finally take the business completely online and stop mailing all those catalogs, stop licking all those envelopes, stop all the stamping and the machines and all this type of thing. So it was great, and I was enjoying it, and then I realized, I said, well, if I need to get people to my website, everybody's going to need to get people to their website, and you have all these businesses coming online, and everybody's talking about building websites, you need to build it, and they were all being told that 40 million people are going to come to your website, and I knew 40 million people were not going to come to your website, so what do you need to do? So I said, well, these hundreds and hundreds of hours of research that I have in finding these free link locations, I said, I can duplicate that. I've got the list. I can have my employee do it in about 2 hours. I pay her $15 an hour. That's 30. I said, you know, so I'll charge, you know, $89.99. And I'll put a directory listing service on the internet. So I took an afternoon, and that's literally what it took to put together this AAA Internet Promotions. AAA back in 1994 is what they called search engine optimization. Okay, that got you to the top of the list. If you were AAA, you came up for A, you became up for AA, and then after that was B. So AAA Internet Promotions, I put it on all these directories, And in 2 weeks, I had a 200-order backlog. I was horrified because I have all these people sending me money all of a sudden. And I doubled the price because I didn't know what else to do. And I say, maybe that'll slow it down. In 3 weeks, I have a 300-order backlog. So I double the price again. And next thing you know, these orders are coming in, and I am getting up in the morning, and I'm just trying to find people who need a job and have a dial-up connection and a computer. And I'm hiring mostly like housewives, and you know they were really the pioneers of the internet. These housewives who were home and looking for things to do and communicating with each other and their students via email. And by the time we moved from Elise Avenue on the Mesa to the Granada Building, third floor of the Granada Building, we had over 40 employees. And these people were coming to my house, and we outgrew the kitchen table, and we went to the dining room table, and then we went to the living room, and the next thing you know, we're at the picnic table in the backyard, you know, having meetings every 2 days, and then we took over the third floor of the Granada Building, and I was able to grow that business into, you know, we had 40 employees working from home, and then we had about 40 more working in the Granada Building, took over the entire third floor, and just started to run. So what I didn't know, and I didn't know most things back then, because, again, I was just winging it. I was just like, oh, crap, what do I do now? Double the price. What do I do now? Get employees. What do I do now? Go get an office. And that's when I talk about winging it. It's like you just get up and you just do. You just like, what do I need to do now? Well, oh, someone said you need a business license. I think I'll go get a business license. What do you need to do now? Oh, you need to have a resale license. Oh, you need go. Let's go talk to them. What do you do? And that's what entrepreneurs do every day. Is you get up and you just keep moving down the path. So AAA Internet Promotions, quite frankly, I don't know how much money it made. It bought us our first house, and our first house was, you know, $320,000. And my wife was pregnant with my son, and so that was all good, and we were making money. And we had lots of employees, but what started to happen, the internet started to grow, and all this competition started to flood in. And this is way back before I knew about venture capital. It's before I understood anything about finance. All I knew was, you take in money, you pay payroll, you pay people, you pay the bills, you take in more money, and hopefully you have something left at the end of the day. So before you know it, I've got a stack of bills this high. And depending on who was calling the most, I'd move their bill to the top. And that was my accounting system for getting things paid. But I knew just in my gut as an entrepreneur that things were not going well and I needed to cut back. And finally, I had to lay off a lot of people and I had to totally reinvent the company. Now, if I had known at that time what hopefully you guys are learning about venture capital, about building teams, about entrepreneurship in general, well, then I would have gone out, raised some venture capital, and who knows where we'd be today. I mean, you know, we'd be doing something else. So we became WebIgnite. We reinvented the company. I got the company down to about 8 people. My best 8 people, and we started WebIgnite because now some search engines were coming into play, like AltaVista and AliWeb and some other earlier search engines. And it became obvious, well, now you need to get higher on the search engine. So we started one of the first SEO companies, which was called WebIgnite. And we did basically everything for everybody. Back in the days of AAA Internet Promotions and WebIgnite, nobody still was talking about getting people to your website. It's a very small group of people talking about building traffic. So WebIgnite kind of evolved. We sold advertising. We did training. We did SEO. And that's when the concept for ValueClick kind of hit me. I said, well, we're going to have all of these millions and millions of websites coming online. And the only place at that time that you could buy advertising was on Yahoo, which is now big. You could buy it on Lycos, and you could buy it on AltaVista and AOL and some of the larger websites. And those were the only options for advertisers to advertise. And it occurred to me, I said, well, there are going to be millions and millions of websites coming on board. Why couldn't we take a banner and somehow put that banner across all these websites? So I didn't have any money, of course, because I was juggling. Everything was a juggle. I didn't have any venture capital. And so I went to a guy named Michael Bueno, who was the original technology guy at ValueClick. And I went to Michael and I said, hey, Michael, here's the concept. I want to upload a banner. I want it to show on 100 websites, 1,000 websites, 10,000, 10 million websites. how do I do that? Can it be done? And he said, oh, yeah, if you can think it, we can do it. And he had a great attitude. And he said, yeah, well, I can do it. It'll take me about 2 months to put this together. I said, okay, well, here's the bad news. I don't have any money. And he's like, oh. Said, but if you build it, I know I could sell. I've got people, they will buy this all day long. You know, let's build a per-click network. Back then, everybody paid for banner advertising on a per impression or how many eyeballs saw the ad. And it seemed to me, well, if they could sell on the eyeballs, if they can sell, you know, how many people saw the ad, I should be able to sell all day long how many people clicked on the ad. So I had a very simple model. I said, well, we're going to upload a banner. It's going to go across 100,000 websites or how many websites we have. And for everyone that clicks on the banner, I'm going to charge the advertiser a dime. And I'm going to pay the publisher or the website owner a nickel. And that was the original vision of ValueClick. So we launched it a couple of months later. And our biggest problem with ValueClick was filling orders. We needed to grow our network, and we needed to add more inventory and add more inventory, and needless to say, it just skyrocketed. So ValueClick started at a very interesting time because we started to grow. I was still juggling the bills, but we had more income coming in, and so happens I did a speaking engagement for one of our clients. After the speaking engagement, a guy comes and approaches me, and he says, Yes, I'd like to talk to you about what you're doing over at WebIgnite. And I said, okay, and what's your interest? He says, I'm an angel investor. I said, an angel investor? I'm thinking, really? This guy's weird, you know? What's an angel investor? I had no idea what this was. He says, I want to come and visit your operation. So he comes down to the Granada building, and a guy by the name of Bob Leppo, and he says, well, this WebIgnite thing is very interesting. Search engine optimization, which is what I was talking about at the speaking engagement. I wasn't talking about ValueClick. It was brand new. And he started to tell me, I'm an angel investor. I invest in companies. And I said, well, forget WebIgnite. I said, look at ValueClick. Here's what ValueClick is. And I started to explain to him. And I said, okay, so here's an order. And we literally would have a piece of paper. Okay, so the banner, I upload the banner. Okay, now it's on 18,000 websites. Really? And I'd visit a few websites, he'd see it. And I would say, okay, now let's go to the stats. And I click reload, and I say, okay, so 200 people saw that banner, 4 people clicked on it. We made 40 cents. Really? And I clicked reload again. I said, okay, now 400 people clicked on it, and four more people clicked on it, 400 people more saw it, and we made another 40 cents. And he started to see this money add up, and he says, whoa, I like this a lot. So he says, I want to invest in ValueClick. I said, well, I don't really know how that works. And Bob Leppo is really an angel investor in every sense of the word. He really sat the entire afternoon and explained to me finance from A to Z on how venture capital works, pre-money valuations, post-money valuations, multiplications and how in valuations, how companies increase in value and on and on. He must have spent 5 or 6 hours with me. And I said, okay, Bob, now I get it. So what do you want? You want to invest. What are you proposing? He says, takes out his checkbook and he writes a check. And how do you spell your last name? And he writes out the check and says, I'm writing a check for $50,000 made out to you personally. And he puts it on the desk. I said, okay. And what do you want for that? He says, I can raise at least $1 million for you in 6 weeks. If I can't, you can take that $50,000 and do whatever you want with it. Really? That's an interesting proposition. And he says, I'm going to raise it at $3 million valuation. I said, okay, that sounds fair. I said, and what do you get if you do raise the money in 6 weeks? He says, that check buys me 5% of ValueClick, $50,000, a $1 million valuation. I said, okay, you got it. So, of course, he neglected to tell me that I was the one that had to go out and raise the money. I was the one that had to put together a PowerPoint presentation, go up to San Francisco, put on a tie, do the dog and pony show, Sand Hill Lane, the whole thing, shaking hands. But he introduced me around, and he helped get ValueClick off the ground. So we raised $1 million, and $1 million, well, it's still a lot of money, but back then it was twice as much. And so I said, wow, now $1 million, I can actually not only worry about making revenue and juggling my bills, I can think about a strategy. I can think about, well, who are we going to be in 6 months? Who are we going to be in 12 months? But not only that, by getting investors involved in my company, it added brain power and it added a lot of connections. One of the first people he introduces me to is a guy by the name Jim Zarley. Jim Zarley was at the time running Best Internet up in the Bay Area, which is one of the first ISPs, and they were merging the company with a company called Highway Technologies out of Florida. And he was up there at a board meeting, and Bob Lepwood had actually sent Jim Zarley. Jim Zarley was a turnaround CEO, so they'd send Jim Zarley in when the investors were scared, they didn't want to lose any more money, they'd send in a turnaround CEO, they'd send in Jim Zarley. And Jim Zarley, he'd get in there and he'd tell me, he'd start in the parking lot. He'd look at the car and say, Mercedes, BMW, these people are getting paid too much. That's the problem. And he'd go in, he was the axeman. He would just cut him down and he was just Mr. Profitability. Mr. Profitability. So they'd send him in there to do that to Best Internet. Jim Zarley is in there in a board meeting, coincidentally, the day I go in. And Bob Lepo walks me in and says, well, Jim, this is Bob. And Jim comes out of a board meeting, and he's a pretty serious-looking guy. And he says, okay, you got 30 seconds. What do you got? And I said, well, this is ValueClick, and there's the revenue. And he said, okay, what's the burn? I said, well, it's profitable. What? I said, it's profitable. Profitable? What do you mean profitable? I said, oh, I showed him. He says, wait here. And he goes into the boardroom, and he marches out with about eight other guys. And he says, tell them what you told me. I said, what? He said, tell them what you told me. I said, profitable? Profitable, he says. It's an internet company. It's profitable. An internet company can be profitable. And this is back in the time when internet companies, I literally would get thrown out of venture capitalist's office. They say, profitable? Get the hell out of here. We don't want profitable business model. Forget it. You know, we need scale. We need big. You know, we want Yahoo. We want, you know, things like that. So he said to the board, he says, profitable. He says, I'm putting $50,000 into this company, and I suggest that you guys do too. Well, those guys, a few of them were still on the board of ValueClick because they got involved, invested $50,000 each, and those were the first staunches of money that we got in. So it was all very exciting times. And again, it's just winging it. I mean, I didn't know what was going to go on. I just show up, and Bob Lepel says, sit here and tell your story. And I sit there and tell my story. And next thing you know, I'm surrounded with Jim Zarley and all these guys who are really, really smart. So they invested in ValueClick, and Jim Zarley became my mentor. And Jim Zarley is one of the smartest guys I've ever known in business. And he just, you know, he could sit down with a piece of paper, and he could say, I'd say, well, how much are you going to do in March? I said, well, I think 100,000. He says, you're not going to do 100,000. Really? No, you're going to do 83,000. I am? And he'd be right on the number all the time. The guy is just, it's like he has ESP on growing a business. So he and I would sit down. We'd be on the phone every 2 or 3 days, and we'd sit down once a month, and we'd pencil out the numbers, and we'd grow the business. So Jim Zarley's method of growing a business has become my method of growing a business. So any business you start off, you have nothing, and you take a leap of faith. You say, okay, I'm going to start this business, and you have to invest some money, but at some point you get to a break-even. Break-even is a very important moment in the life of a company, because break-even is a point when you are on your own. You're your own person. You're your own company. You're not beholden to anybody. As Jim Zarley would say, you never want to show up with your hat in your hands. You never want to have to go and beg for money. You never want to be in a position where you need money. If you're in a position where you need money, you're going to get crushed. So let's get to break-even. Now, when we get to break-even, now we'll spend money. So we're going to get to break-even. Our break-even is going to be $70,000 a month. When we get to $70,000 a month, we're going to make a conscious decision to invest $50,000 a month in marketing. And that $50,000 a month in marketing is going to result in an increasing top-line revenue. So the first month, you're going to lose $50,000. The next month, you're going to lose $40,000. Next month, you're going to lose $30,000. And when you come back to break-even, now you're break-even at a much higher level than you were before. So when you were break even at $50,000, now you break even, but you're taking in $100,000 a month. So now what do? You say, okay, everything's fine, everything's copacetic, let's invest $100,000 a month. And you start to invest $100,000 a month, and you grow that company from $100,000 a month Next month is 120,000. Next month's 140,000. Next month's 170,000. And then you break even maybe at $250,000 and you break even again. So the whole methodology behind this Jim Zarley's methodology of growing a business is at any time when you hit a barrier, you hit a roadblock that you can't overcome for whatever reason, and there's nothing but barriers and roadblocks in business, then you can always say, okay, well, let's rebuild the business like it was last quarter because we were profitable. So if we were 50 people, we'll have 50 people. If, you know, if we had this expense, these expenses and these profitabilities, that's what we want to look like. So at any point in time, you can revert back. So that gives you a level of comfort, a level of satisfaction, allows you and your investors to sleep at night. And that's one of the many, many things he taught me, is that you're going to take an investor capital, you want your investors to sleep at night, you don't want them calling you on the phone, you want them comfortable, you want to communicate with them, you want to have a methodology and just be transparent with them. So we grew ValueClick over the next few years. We raised a couple more tranches of money. But in the next few years, we got it to $56 million. And it's a huge amount of money. And then needless to say, it's a huge amount of stress. And a startup is an absolute roller coaster. And I kind of forgot it because I just recently, a year ago, got back into a new startup. And it all started coming back to me. But it's like, oh my God, it's like one day you're up here and the next day you're down here. And it's an absolute roller coaster from, wow, we got a great contract. Hey, we lost a contract. Hell, we got, you know, the best employee in the world. Oh, we lost five. You know, whatever it is, you know, the startup environment is just an environment of extreme uncertainty, and there's nothing but barriers, and it's an absolute roller coaster. So this roller coaster that lasted, you know, they called me an overnight success, and they gave me the Entrepreneur of the Year Award, Ernst & Young Entrepreneur of the Year Award, and I was this overnight success. It wasn't overnight. It took a lot of hard work, and it took a lot of team building, and it took a lot of riding that roller coaster. So when we went public on March 31st of 2000, I was elated, needless to say. I was beyond a rich man. I had more money than I could ever spend in a lifetime, and it was only going to grow from there because this internet thing, if you were worth $100 million, you're going to be worth $1 billion next month and $10 billion next month. So thankfully, I was able to convince Jim Zarley to become the CEO of the company before it went public, because I never wanted to become the CEO of a public company. I had always envisioned myself, hey, I'm going to get rich. I'm going to go buy a dive shop or a surf shop, and I'm just going to, you know, I'm going to get a boat, and I'm going to get some ranch property, and I'm going to surf, and I'm going to travel the world, and so that was my plan. So March 31st, 2000, became a very wealthy man, and there were a lot of huge parties, a lot of craziness going on, because the first 8 employees also became multimillionaires at ValueClick. All the investors became much richer than they came in. It was a very, very happy time. And we were riding around in limos and having $100,000 parties and all this. And it was great, but boy, was I tired. I was ready for that retirement. So that's when my retired life kind of began. So March 31st, 2000, we were still at Westlake Village. I mean, we were still at Carpinteria, our offices. And I stayed there for a while as the chief visionary officer, which mostly I surfed. But, you know, I had the board in my office. And I actually, you know, we were down the block from Rincon. And so it was like, oh, well, nobody here, nobody looking for me. I'd sneak out again, until I felt guilty for even taking a salary, and I stopped taking a salary. And then they moved down to Westlake Village, and I was like, I'm not going to Westlake Village. Like, they can keep Westlake Village. Good riddance, ValueClick. I'm just going to stay on the board. And so I stayed on the board for a while until I realized I couldn't sell stock if I'm on the board, because I always have insider information. You can't sell stock if you have insider information. So I got off the board and finally got my freedom. And then I just started, you know, surfing and fishing and diving and traveling and learning to fly airplanes and everything else. And that lasted 6 months. And then 6 months into it, you know, my wife got tired of looking at me. She's like, are you here again? Oh, my God. She's like, how do I get this guy out of my house? So she says to me, she says, you know, why don't you do another business? I said, no. Never again. I can't take it. You know, I mean, I can't take it. And, you know, I was 38, 39 years old. Didn't ever have to work again, but I was like, no, I don't want to do another business. He said, well, what about that harbor you love so much? Why don't you go down there and see if you could buy a business? So I went down there, and it turned out there was a business I could buy, and I bought a yacht brokerage down there. And it was supposed to be, I bought it for the office. I don't know if you guys know Brophy Brothers down there, but my office is right next door. I look out over the harbor, and it is literally the nicest office in the world to me, anyway. I see all the fish coming in. I can go get the fresh fish, and it's beautiful. I've got my boat there. It's luxury. And I got into business with a guy who was going to run the business, and I was just going to be kind of the investor. And, I'd be the silent investor, and I'd just sit in my office and do whatever, and stay out of the house, stay out of my wife's way, go fish and go surfing. And but my partner turned out to be a raging alcoholic and who would show up at 8 o'clock in the morning, like, loaded. And every day after day, and it turned out I had to get rid of him. And guess what? I had to rebuild the whole business from the ground up, and it was this thing. So I ended up rebuilding that business. And then I started to, get satisfied with doing some business, but just doing it in kind of light touches. And I started to invest in other businesses, and I started to sit on boards, and I started to do advising. So slowly I started to get, pulled back into this whole entrepreneurial lifestyle. But at the same time, I kept my freedom for about 10 years. And I did a lot of traveling. I learned to fly airplanes. I bought an airplane. I had 3 airplanes, actually. Not at once, but in succession. I started buying shopping malls, hotels, just traveling, just living large. Spent a year in Europe with my family. Just did everything you think you want to do, and then still being involved with business, because I love business. I love entrepreneurship. And I love to be involved with entrepreneurs. I love to be around smart people that are making things happen. And then we did a year overseas where we sailed for 3 months through Croatia, Greece, and Turkey, and spent the winter in Spain, and got back in the summer of 2011. And then I turned 50 in September of 2011. I was already thinking, I think I want to do it again. And I didn't remember how hard it really was. I had all these ideas in my head that, oh, man. I remembered all the good times, I remembered all the parties, all the happy faces when everybody got rich. And I remembered all the happy investors. And I didn't remember the employee issues and the problems when the server went down. And, there were times at ValueClick. One comes to mind, and, at ValueClick, our entire business was in one machine. Okay, our entire business was on one hard drive. And one morning I got up, again, winging it, I got up and there's this frickin' storm. It's as bad as Santa Barbara gets, period. The people literally were swimming under the freeway at Garden Street. Okay, there were people swimming. There were people like jumping off the poles. They're in boats and the whole thing. And I'm driving around and the banners are down. And back in those days, if the banner went down and the banner was at the top of the page, if the banner went down, the website wouldn't load, if you can believe that. So the banners are down. And if the banners went down, that means our publishers would hate us, and they'd take off the banner. And it was our biggest problem finding these publishers, so we couldn't stand to lose publishers. So next thing you know, I'm driving around town with my cell phone. It's like a cell phone. Driving around my town with my cell phone, and I'm looking for a generator. And Michael's up there, oh, no, well, they might have one for rent over here, and they had one for sale, but they just sold it, and I'm driving all over town frantic. Finally, he says, I found an outlet. I said, well, and we're in the third floor of the Granada building. He said, well, where's the outlet? He says, it's at Arts and Letters Cafe, which is down out the back window, 3 stories and across. So I went over to the hardware store over on Olive Street, and they didn't have any electricity, so cash deals only. And I bought, I think, every extension cord that they had in the entire place. And we ran that extension cord down 3 stories and across half a block and plugged it in. Banners are up! Banners are up! Oh, my God. Oh, my God. I mean, we literally, you talk about a roller coaster, we literally could have lost the business in that moment. And now we had investors, now we had employees. There was a lot of commerce coming in on that little stupid machine. We took that machine, we said, well, we can't have this, we need to go to a center. We need to go to a hosting center. So there was one down in Marina del Rey, And we decided a couple of weeks later we were going to run it down there. So we had to figure out when our traffic was the absolute lowest. And we considered hiring an ambulance or a fire truck or something to like zoom it down there. But we actually didn't have to do that. We actually, Michael Bueno and I got up like 3:15 in the morning and, okay, you ready? Unplug it. Banners are down. Put it in the back. Drive carefully. You know, down to Marina Del Rey. Plug the server back in. Oh, are the banners up? Are the banners up? I don't know. Reload. So they up. Banners are up. Oh, okay. We can breathe again. So anyway, not to revert back, but the roller coaster of a startup is astounding. So I forgot all this on my 50th birthday, and I just remembered all these great times and these great parties and everything else, and I'm going to do it again. So I was looking for something to do, and that's when I was helping, coincidentally, a hotel that I own a Hampton Inn in Wisconsin, Plover, Wisconsin. Don't ask. Anyway, trying to help them because the recession has been tough on them, do their online marketing, and I'm trying to figure out, you know, well, why aren't they on Google Places? Well, let's make a Google Places page. Why aren't they on Yahoo? Let's make a Yahoo page. Well, why aren't they on Bing? Let's make a Bing page. And I started to do it, and I said, well, this is like the directory listing service all over again, being people listed on directories. And I said, well, let me find a company to do this for me. And I saw all these companies trying to do it and not really getting it. And I started to look at this local space, and I realized, wow, everybody needs to be found locally now, right? So it's like this full circle of the internet. All of a sudden, it's not just Google. People need to be on Yelp. If you're a restaurant and you're not on Yelp, you're not found. If you're a hotel and you're not on TripAdvisor, you're not found. So, wow. So I started to absorb this whole local space, and I started to get entrenched with it. In the meantime, I'm trying to figure out where I'm going to jump back in on the internet, and I just figured, you know, I can self-fund the startup. I know a few people. I've got a little bit of a claim to fame. Smarter than I've ever been. I'm going to do another startup. So I'm looking, and I realized, I said, wow, over the last 5-6 years, I bet every business owner, when they marched at Yellow Pages from their doorstep to their recycle bin, they said, oh, I know where I can save some money. I said, I wonder how much, if that number has been quantified. There's got to be a number out there. So I found out the number. And over the last 5 years, $7.1 billion in revenue loss from these Yellow Page ads getting canceled. And I thought to myself, well, these business owners, because of the recession, have been putting that money in their pocket. And I started to get really excited. I started to smell blood. And I said, okay, there's profit to be had here. Okay, what's going on? So I started to really investigate the local space. So a year ago, almost exactly, January 3rd of 2012, we launched Local Market Launch website. And we said, we'll get you listed on Google, Yahoo, Bing, Google Places. We'll get you put out through all the channels. So it's been a ride, let me tell you. It's been a ride, and now that I remember ValueClick, and it's all pouring back to me now, I'm like, oh, yeah, it wasn't all fun and games and easy. And somebody in one of our meetings said, yeah, you know, startups are a lot of fun, but mostly in hindsight. It's kind of like high school, you know. Everybody, oh, high school was so great. Well, you know what? Talk to a high school kid. They're not having that much fun. You know, you know, talk to my son. He'd be like, yeah, high school. Yeah, he could leave it before he takes it. So anyway, the last year has been just an absolute roller coaster, and we've been figuring things out, building teams, sometimes tearing down half the team and rebuilding the team, pivoting the product, figuring out what we're doing. But it's been a fun ride. But, you know, entrepreneurship, again, is all about winging it. It's all about, you know, you don't know what's going to happen next. You know, when I met John Greathouse, I was trying to raise money. Somehow, I'm here standing in front of you, and I don't have any of his money. So, you know. So this is all part of winging it. So, you know, my story of entrepreneurship, you know, I think that it's really, it's taught me so much. It's taught me that what my strengths are. I think a lot of why I'm successful, how I'm able to be successful, is that I've learned over time what my strengths are. I know what I'm not good at. I'm not good at accounting. pretty good. I'm good at spreadsheets and P&Ls. I can do everything pretty well, but there are some things that I'm really good at. I'm really good at motivating people. I'm really good at building great teams. I'm really good at sharing my vision. And I think that the essence of entrepreneurship is really, you have to have a belief. If you're going to get up and wing it, I came in here tonight to wing it. I said, okay, I'm just going to wing it. I mean, I'm going to tell my story. I know my story, but I'm just going to wing it. You know, I don't have a PowerPoint presentation. I'm not hiding behind any slides. I'm just going to do it. And how do I do that? Well, it all boils down to belief, you know, and everything in entrepreneurship, if you really look at it, boils down to you absolutely have to believe it as deep can get, that you can do it. And I knew coming in here, I believed I could do it. So here I am doing it. When I'm doing this business and I develop a product, I believe very deeply in that product. So I'm able to convince employees, but not just employees. I'm able to convince leaders in the industry. I'm able to steal senior VPs from my competitor. I'm able to hire people for $100,000 a year when their last job they got $500,000 a year. I'm able to attract people. I'm able to bring on investors. And the way I'm able to do that is because of my belief. The way I'm able to surround myself with smart people, the way I'm able to bring in investor capital, and the way I'm able to keep people motivated is a deep set belief. So I think that's really at the core of entrepreneurship. So winging it and the belief, and you know, I started with looking at that UCSB catalog and seeing those perfect waves. I now surf those perfect waves. I didn't get to go to the college, but hey, here I am doing the guest lecture, so I think that's even just as good. Huh? So that's my story today.
All right, so we have plenty of time for a Q&A. And we want to try to use the microphones just so we get it on video. I'm going to start with a question, and then I'll get the microphone to the next person. So, Brian, I'm always curious. You've hired a lot of people. Mm-hmm. You've seen a lot of people come and go. What, when you think back to folks that you hired and they excelled beyond their peers, whether they were a senior person or a junior person, what kind of comes to mind? Like, what were the attributes that caused them to stand out? Because I want you guys, I want everybody in this classroom to stand out once you get out in the workforce.
Attitude, number one. Before anything is attitude. You know, people who come in and they've got an attitude. Like right now, I interviewed a guy today who's a senior sales trainer. We're talking about building a sales force, and he built a sales force from people straight out of college. He just did it in Las Vegas for another company, and we're talking about doing a similar thing because I want to hire straight out of UCSB. I want to hire straight out of City College. I think this is the pool of labor that I want to go after. And he said the attitude is number one. He says he would interview 10 people, and 10 people say, well, I've got my diploma now, so you know I've got my certificate. I want $80,000 a year, and where's my cushy desk job, and what time do we go, and you know how long is lunch, and when's my next vacation? And then there are people with an actual work ethic, people who want to come in, and they want to succeed, and they want to work hard. They're willing to work hard. And he said he had to weed through 10, 12 people to get one that he felt could do that. And then of the one that he felt could do it, you know, every other one of those, he wasn't quite right. So attitude is number one. If you show up and you've got a great attitude, every one of you in this room is more than smart enough to work at my company or to work at his company or to do sales or to do business development or to do any number of things. You guys have so much talent when it comes around the technology piece, et cetera, that you know, people my age can't hold a candle to you. You guys are fast. You just get it. The social media thing, it's like you're all over it. But if you've got a crap attitude, I don't want you. You know, we had an interview with one girl who came 10 minutes late for the interview, had a big old Starbucks thing in her hand. And you know what? I sat down with her, and I was like, you know, I could tell she was really cocky, but I could tell she was really smart, really, really, really smart. And boy, I would have loved to hire her, but she didn't come in 5-10 minutes late with a Starbucks in her hand and have that cocky attitude. She'd be there, because there's no question in my mind she could have done a job. She could have done a great job. But anybody who has an attitude issue like that, you know, they don't work. So
I totally agree.
Hi.
So you were obviously kind of put into a big position of leadership very early on. And what kind of techniques did you utilize or learn along the way to be a good leader and also just to manage so many people? Kind of what management techniques have you developed and what would you kind of recommend?
Well, you know, management techniques, I would say, are like my business techniques. My business techniques are based on only creating win-win scenarios. So when I do business with another company and we draw up some type of agreement, some type of contract, we create a win-win scenario. And I like to always keep everything transparent. So when I get employees, I bring them into my office and I kind of give them my little spiel. And my spiel says, you know, I keep everything transparent. I am not going to BS you. If there's something about you that I'm not liking, I am going to tell you. I am sitting here promising you that. I want you to promise me the same thing. If there's something that you're not liking, I want you to promise me. Just tell me. And then we keep it on the table and we keep it transparent. And that helps a lot in the whole communication. And then from a management perspective, I look at my job as I'm not here to make sure you show up on time. I'm not here to make sure you do your job. My job is to make your job easier. So I go to my employees, I say, what can I do to make you more productive? What can I do to make you happier? What can I do to make your job easier? And having been an employee and having worked for some really bad bosses, you know, I learned very early on that that's a great technique. So those two things combined with a sincere appreciation and appreciation, in my opinion, is the greatest motivator. You know, I bring people in my office and tell them how much I appreciate them, and I mean, it's they love it. And I don't do it. I'm not stroking them. I mean, I do appreciate them. So I bring them in, I tell them I appreciate them. So appreciation, transparency, and just really a heartfelt care for their success. I want every person in my company to succeed. Right now we're about 16 people. I want every person. There may be one or two that I'm a little worried about. And it's not because they're bad people. It's because, you know, they're not the right person at the right time in the right chair doing the right thing. None of them, thankfully, right now have attitude problems because that's another issue. But, you know, I want truly every one of their success. And they know it. And so when I bring them in and I tell them that they're not doing something right or you know, I need to see more effort in one thing or another, they take it great. And then I tell them how much I appreciate the stuff that they're doing. So my management technique is just to be very transparent, approachable, and to look out for the success of everybody in my company.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.